Today is Monday, January 2nd. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemelin. You're listening to News 101.
Here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residence of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on the internet.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. It's nothing more for any. Take it slow for now. Here I am, here you are. Take it slow for now.
I think math can set us free if we are brave enough. No emotion.
Good evening, it is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this, plus your weekday weather forecast, right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news. And now for the national headlines. To start off the national headlines, the locomotive maker Electromotive started the new year by locking Canadian auto worker members out of its plant in London, Ontario. Contract talks hit a wall last week after the company issued a final offer that would cut the wages of union members in half and make massive cuts to pensions and other benefits. The previous contract, which included more than 420 CAW workers, expired at the start of the new year, and union members marked the occasion by setting up a picket line last night. Canadian Auto Workers President Ken Loenza issued a statement blaming corporate greed for the lockout, pointing to the fact that Electromotive is owned by one of the richest heavy equipment companies in the world, Caterpillar. Loenza says this lockout is a serious attack on working people, their families, and the Greater London area. The Ontario Federation of Labour are throwing their hats into the ring as well. President Sid Ryan said the OFL, which represents 54 unions and 1 million workers in Ontario, is ready to mobilize and help CAW stop scabs from crossing the picket lines at the London plant. Ryan even went so far as to suggest that the situation in London underscores a need for provincial legislation to ban the use of replacement workers during strikes and lockouts.
Rio Tinto Alcan has locked out workers at its smelter in Alma, Quebec, after last-ditch contract talks collapsed this Saturday and the union's contract expired at midnight on Saturday. On Friday, about 780 workers from three negotiating units rejected what the company said would be its final offer. Rio Tinto Alcan announced the lockout early Sunday morning, saying that plans were in place to ensure its aluminium operations continue to run safely and efficiently. The company said about 200 managers will work, however, at the plant during the lockout. The union leaders, however, at the Quebec smelter are accusing managers of hiring illegal replacement workers after locking out the unionized employees on Sunday.
Interim Liberal leader Bob Rae took one last jab at the Conservatives before the new year. On Friday, Rae stood before the cream of Canada's press corps and denounced Conservative plans to raise employment insurance premiums. Good old Bobby accused the government of breaking their campaign promise by raising taxes, pointing out that ordinary Canadians are seeing tax hikes while rich corporations are getting tax cuts. The government is expected to follow through with a plan to continue corporate cuts, lowering the rate from 16.5% to 15% this January. Ray also pointed out that although EI premiums are being raised, workers who handle EI claims are being laid off, which makes for lengthier processing, causing many Canadians to resort to food banks and miss their rent payments. Here's what Ray had to say about the timing of the EI premium hike.
But if you were to ask any economist in the country, or frankly any person with any common sense, what is the worst time to be raising taxes on employment, you'd say it's at a time when unemployment is increasing and growing, which is exactly what's happening today.
Well, then that means that if you were in power, would you continue to run a bigger deficit, or would you hike the EI premiums? Which one would it be?
No, as you did, but you're creating a totally false choice, because the person who is today creating a bigger deficit is Mr. Harper. It is Mr. Harper who's creating a bigger deficit today. Why is the deficit growing today? It's growing, first of all, because they're spending money in places where they shouldn't be spending it. Secondly, because they're cutting a corporate tax when there's absolutely no need to do that in order to maintain a competitive economy. And they're not doing anything to create further growth and innovation in the economy. So it's not about, you know, who's in favor of a big deficits or not. Nobody wants to run a deficit. But we do have to recognize that we've got ourselves into the federal government got itself into a deficit, and the federal government itself has said it's going to take longer to get out of it. What I'm saying very clearly is this is not the time to be raising employment insurance premiums, because that's exactly what's going to be stopping employers from creating jobs, and it's going to be taking money right out of the pockets of low-income people. It's not a progressive tax. It's a tax that hits all employees. It's a tax that takes money out of people's pockets at a time when that's not where we should be going. But if you look at the spending agenda of the Conservatives, think about it for a moment. They're going to be spending more money on prisons, billions more on prisons. They're announcing that they're going to be spending less money on health care as we project out into the future. And they're going to be spending money on fighter jets without even having had a competition to decide on which jet is going to be the most effective for Canada. So, you know, this is a government that, in fact, is a big spending, profligate government at the same time as they say they want to cut. There's no evidence that they really want to cut where it counts.
Luckily for the finance minister, his spokesperson, Chisholm Poitier, defended the increase in EI premiums, saying the government is raising EI premiums by less than they said they would. Poitier said that the average family of four gets about $3,000 in extra cash savings because of measures introduced by the Conservatives.
Last week, News 101 talked about how the BC government says it will begin working with national and municipal officials this January to prepare for the massive wave of debris heading to the Pacific Northwest shores because of the March 11 earthquake and tsunami in Japan. Meanwhile, residents in the BC coastal community of Tofino are bracing themselves for the unfortunate but possible arrival of human remains along with the lumber and household items in the debris field. For more on this, we go to a report by the Globe and Mail.
Swept to sea, as much as 20 million tons of debris may have been pulled into the Pacific after the tsunami struck Japan's coast. Carried by wind and ocean currents, a field of floating wreckage called Flotsam, roughly the size of California, is on a path for the west coast of North America. But not all that went into the water will wash up on these shores.
You're going to have the Flotsam go four places. Some's going to sink, which might be a quarter. Some's going to come to North America, which might be a quarter. Some's going to go around back to Japan, which might be a quarter. 6 years later, some's going to get to Hawaii, some's going to go into the garbage patch, which would be a quarter, roughly.
This large buoy found on a beach in northwestern Washington, he believes, is the first arrival, and it's just the tip of the iceberg.
We are not prepared for this. Nobody is prepared. Nobody has even thought through the dimensions. This is unprecedented in scientific history. It's unprecedented in recorded history. There's never been a devastation on one continent that has moved off to the other continent and actually recorded.
Scientists like Ebismeyer say the debris could bring toxic or radioactive contamination from Japan all the way here, and that it could impact marine life and even maritime shipping. They also worry about the specter of body parts from the tsunami, which left 20,000 missing or dead, washing ashore. But oceanographers at the government agency responsible for dealing with such events say there's no cause for alarm.
Items that we expect on the shoreline are mostly lumber, maybe some items that have to do with the infrastructure there, the industrial infrastructure, and household items. So we don't expect any debris items that are exotic or unusual.
And so far, that's what's turned up. But that hasn't stopped beachcombers from going on the hunt. If they find personal items from the tsunami, they can report it online in the hopes that one day those items might be matched with their owner and find their way across the Pacific back home.
Julian McCaffrey, a spokeswoman for the Emergency Management BC, part of the Ministry of Public Safety and Solicitor General, has confirmed that the BC government is creating a provincial tsunami debris working group that will deal with this situation.
Those are your national headlines. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I am Martin Levelin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lumlin. Thank you for being with us. It's now time for international news. Hosni Mubarak's trial resumed in Cairo today amid whisperings that the ousted Egyptian leader might finagle himself a dismissal. These speculations began to bud after five policemen were acquitted of killing protesters last Thursday. In that case, the court found that three of the defendants weren't at the site of the killings, and that the other two fired on protesters in self-defense. The ruling appalled families of the victims, as activists demand that the killers be brought to justice. Mubarak, who is now an 83-year-old man who had to be taken into the defendant's cage on a gurney, faces charges with his two sons, Gamal and Alaa, as well as the ousted leader's former security chief and top six police commanders. They are charged with complicity in the killing of more than 800 protesters during last year's uprising that toppled his 29-year regime, as well as an additional corruption charges.
Iran tested a medium-range radar-evading missile on Sunday and claims that it made a new advance in its nuclear program a day after the United States placed more sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Iranian state-run and semi-official media agencies on Sunday heavily publicized the country testing its first domestically produced nuclear fuel rod, citing reports from the country's Atomic Energy Organization. Press TV said Iran's disputed nuclear program tested, quote, various physical and dimensional aspects of the rod while inserting it into the reactor core of a Tehran nuclear power plant. In a separate development, the Mehr News Agency reported that Iran launched a surface-to-air missile called the Mehrab. It was during the power stage of the 10-day naval war games that started more than a week ago, the news agency said. On Saturday, U.S. President Barack Obama signed into law new sanctions that target Iran's central banks and its financial sector, according to a White House statement, resulting in Iran's currency hitting a record low.
The death toll from months of flooding in Thailand has risen above 800, although the waters have receded in many parts of the country, the government said Saturday. At their height, Thailand's worst flood in half a century affected 65 of 77 provinces in the low-lying nation, deluged hundreds of thousands of homes, and forced the closure of large industrial parks, disrupting global supply chains. The waters have since receded significantly, but more than 2 million people in 5 provinces continue to be affected, and many areas still face a major cleanup operation.
Firefighters in Chile are tackling dozens of forest fires which have killed one person and destroyed 230 square kilometers, or 57,000 acres of land, in Chile's southern and central regions. To put that into perspective, that area is equivalent to the entire area of the cities of Vancouver and Richmond combined. President Sebastián Piñera said Chile was in a, quote, situation of extreme vulnerability. As of Sunday, he said that more than 500 firefighters were battling 48 separate fires, 15 of which were not yet under control. The president said almost 130 square kilometers, had been burnt down in the Torres del Paine National Park in Patagonia. For more on this, we go to BBC News for a report by Eric Camara.
This is Torres del Paine in Chile, one of South America's most picturesque national parks. But a raging fire has already destroyed more than 14,000 acres of Patagonian land, helped by winds of up to 100 kilometers an hour. Around 120 firemen are fighting the flames, and more aircraft and soldiers are on the way. Still, there's no end in sight.
This is a complex and risky fire, because the topography of the area makes access for rescue personnel to combat the fire very difficult.
Safety concerns have led authorities to close the popular national park. Around 700 tourists had to be evacuated from the area.
It was very sad because it's a beautiful place, a tourist site we've been hoping to see for a long time.
Authorities say the fire at Torres del Paine, near the Argentinian border, is likely to have been caused by a visitor. In 2005, in another fire incident, more than 37,000 acres of the park were destroyed. Eric Camara, BBC News.
Thank you to BBC News for that report.
NASA's latest mission to understand more about the formation of the moon was deemed a success yesterday. On New Year's Eve, the space probe GRAIL A swung over the moon's south pole, fired its engine, and braked into orbit. Its twin, GRAIL B, executed the same move yesterday, capping a roundabout journey that took nearly 4 months and spanned over 4 million kilometers. To be perfectly blunt, we're pretty much obsessed with the moon. More than 100 missions worldwide have been made to the moon, had made the moon its target. NASA flew 6 Apollo missions and landed 12 men on its surface, and brought back more than 360 kilograms of rock and soil samples. But the moon still remains a mystery. Mission Chief Scientist Maria Zuber of MIT says that researchers know more about Mars than we do the moon. One of the trickier riddles has been the moon's lopsided shape, the far side being more jagged and hill-strewn than the side visible from Earth. Late last year, a research paper was published suggesting that Earth once had two moons that crashed early in our solar system's history and created the moon we see today. It's hoped that the GRAIL probes will provide scientists with the most detailed maps of the moon's uneven gravitational field and insight into its interior, all the way down to the core. But data collection won't start until March, when the spacecrafts refine their positions, circling just under 55 kilometers from the surface.
The Obama administration announced last week it had finalized a $29.4 billion sale of Boeing F-15s and other arms to Saudi Arabia. This is the single largest arms deal in the military history of the United States. For more on this, we go to a news report by Newsy.
Inside those headphones is...
We will have that news report in...
A matter of...
20 seconds, in about 20 seconds.
Well, for more on that, News 101 looked into this arms deal, and apparently the United States has been making several of these across the Middle East region, especially in Oman, in United Arab Emirates, and in Iraq as well. For more on this, we go to Newsy.
It is the first part to what would be the U.S.'s largest foreign arms sale in history. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia have struck a $29.4 billion deal that would provide the Royal Saudi Air Force with more than 80 brand new fighter jets. Fox News has details.
This deal was actually approved last year by Congress. Now, the F-15 is not our most advanced fighter, but it's still a pretty powerful jet, and Saudi Arabia is going to get a lot of them. 84 brand new F-15s, upgrades to 70 others, and this is a big deal worth about $30 billion.
The New York Times calls the deal dramatic evidence of the Obama administration's determination to maintain military power in an oil-rich region. The Times highlights the timing of the announcement. Though the White House said the deal had not been accelerated to respond to threats by Iranian officials in recent days to shut off the Strait of Hormuz, its timing is laden with significance as tensions with Iran have deepened and the United States has withdrawn its last soldiers from Iraq. As one analyst tells CNN, putting pressure on Iran by arming its neighbors is not a new strategy for the U.S., though he notes the recent power shuffles in the Middle East may hinder its efficacy.
Remember, what President Bush tried to do was create a kind of Sunni axis against Shia Iran by arming our Sunni allies, our so-called moderate Sunni allies. I'm not exactly sure if that's the best idea going forward, because as you know, this is not the Middle East that we were dealing with during the Bush administration. We no longer have just a handful of dictators that we can tell what to do.
And a blog on Center for New American Security points out another key factor behind the announcement, the elections. The fighter jets will be built in Boeing's assembly lines just outside of St. Louis, Missouri, a state President Obama narrowly lost in the 2008 elections. Canceling the deal with Saudi Arabia would have been a tremendous blow to both Boeing and the people of St. Louis. I'm not among those who argue we should keep U.S. defense spending high in order to support the U.S. economy, but in this case, I think it's naive to assume U.S. domestic politics did not play at least a small role in this sale. And finally, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch highlights how the transaction will affect the city's economy. The deal promises job security through at least 2020 to about 2,000 Boeing production workers here. Boeing hopes to start filling the Saudi orders in 2015. A deal that will keep an estimated 60,000 people employed across the nation. Likely will not create any new jobs, though, in St. Louis. The $30 billion transaction is a part of a total $60 billion arms deal set to be fulfilled within 10 years. On top of the fighter jets, the package will also include, among others, an array of missiles and hundreds of helicopters. I'm Jim Flink for Newsy. Multiple sources, the real story.
Thank you to Newsy for that report. Those are your international headlines. For more international headlines, we will go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Ohio's governor ordered four more fracking wells shut down after an earthquake near Youngstown on Saturday. Evan Davis has more.
The 4.0 magnitude earthquake struck near Youngstown, Ohio over the weekend, marking the 11th seismic event in that area since last year. The Ohio Seismic Network listed the quake's epicenter as being within one-tenth of a mile of a 9,000-foot injection well operated by Youngstown-based D&L Energy, which uses the well to dispose of toxic waste fluid from natural gas wells in Pennsylvania. The well is just 2 miles from downtown Youngstown. Earthquakes associated with the controversial gas drilling method known as fracking and the associated deep well disposal of fracking fluids have been recorded in other parts of the United States and Europe. Arkansas has experienced more than 800 quakes in the last 12 months, prompting officials there to issue a moratorium on new injection wells. The Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which shut down another injection well near Youngstown last Friday, says there is not yet conclusive evidence linking the wells to the sudden spate of earthquakes in the otherwise seismologically neutral region, and industry groups dispute any link. After Saturday's tremor in Youngstown, Ohio's governor ordered a closure of injection wells within a 5-mile radius, a precaution that State Senator Bob Hagan of Youngstown feels may not be sufficient. Hagan introduced a bill last May that would ban injection wells throughout Ohio. Today, Hagan renewed a request for a legislative hearing on the bill. Evan Davis, FSRN.
The last of the Occupy the Vote D.C. hunger strikers broke his fast yesterday. Adrian Parsons was one of five people who sought to highlight the lack of full federal representation for residents of the District of Columbia. After 25 days, Parsons ended his fast due to medical concerns. He said today that the fight for D.C. statehood continues with multiple initiatives, including a petition drive, a series of single-day strikes, and a so-called rider finder. Parsons defines the term.
D.C.'s people's representative funded by a one-cent bottled water tax for on all bottled water sold in the district, both as a luxury tax and as a tax to fund the position. For someone who will do what we've been doing this whole time we've been striking, which is to advocate for continued D.C. freedom.
Residents of the nation's capital currently elect shadow representatives to Congress, unpaid representatives, who have no vote. One protester was killed in Indian-administered Kashmir today when paramilitary troops guarding a power plant opened fire on a rally against long power cuts in the region. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
The incident took place this afternoon in Bonyar village in North Kashmir. Officials said that Central Industrial Security Forces guarding a power plant opened fire on protesters calling for an end to long power cuts in the region. One man was killed and two others were injured. Indian-administered Kashmir faces an acute power shortage in the winter months. There is also resentment against the Indian power giant NHPC, which owns major hydropower plants in the region, but supplies most of it to North Indian states. Kashmir gets a mere 12% royalty from the plants. Trying to quell the tension, the state government said it has arrested five of the security troops and lodged a protest with the Indian Home Ministry. Officials also blamed the NHPC, which hires the federal paramilitary, for not asking for help from local police. The state, which had been blaming power pilferage and increased demand for the power shortage, now says it has pressed gas turbines into service to augment the power supply. Protesters in Bonyar, however, swelled after the killing. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
Bahraini security forces fired on protesters following the funeral of a 15-year-old boy killed during a protest. Troops used flash grenades and tear gas to disperse thousands who gathered yesterday on Sitra, an island off Bahrain's coast. Syed Saeed died Saturday. His family says he was killed by a tear gas canister fired at close range. Authorities say his injuries were not consistent with that claim and called for the public prosecutor to investigate. The country's police chief announced that 500 new officers would be recruited across communities in the island nation that hosts a U.S. naval base. The dominantly Shia population claims widespread discrimination at the hands of Sunni leaders. The Secretary General of the Arab League says that despite tanks backing out of Syrian residential areas, killings continue. The local coordinating committees say that nearly 400 people have died since the monitors arrived last week, including a 7-year-old boy. Critics of the mission to stop President Bashar al-Assad's repression of dissent claim that Syrian authorities are restricting the observers, and the Arab parliament called for them to leave. But the leader of the League, Nabil al-Arabi, noted that about 3,500 prisoners have been released since observers arrived and said the League will not back down. The now weeks-old UN estimate of the death toll in Syria stands at 5,000. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
As people across the country celebrated the close of 2011, President Obama signed the controversial National Defense Authorization Act into law, despite concerns from civil liberties groups about provisions on military detention, the suspension of due process, and the Guantanamo Bay prison. In a statement released on New Year's Eve, President Obama described his serious reservations to some sections of the bill and promised to apply the law in a way that respects the Constitution. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports from Washington.
On Saturday, President Obama released a signing statement explaining which sections of the National Defense Authorization Act are legally objectionable and how the White House will work around them. The questionable provisions in the 500-plus page bill include a ban on funding for the transfer of detainees from Guantanamo, the indefinite detention of suspected foreign terrorists, and the authorization of military detention for U.S. citizens. That same day, the president released a video of his New Year's address.
There's no doubt that 2012 will bring even more change. And as we head into the new year, I'm hopeful that we have what it takes to face that change and come out even stronger.
Although he discussed the payroll tax cut debate and his American Jobs Act, the president's speech included no mention of the defense bill, which the White House had previously threatened to veto as it made its way through Congress. The president withdrew that threat after language was added allowing him to waive mandatory military detention. Seeking to reassure his critics amidst an outcry from major civil liberties groups, President Obama wrote, "My administration will not authorize the indefinite military detention without trial of American citizens." However, many of the provisions in this bill will be on the books indefinitely, and another administration may interpret them differently.
God knows who will be the next president of the United States. They may not take the same cautious.
That's Muhammad Salim Akhtar, director of the American Muslim Task Force on Civil Rights. Akhtar says this new law may further the government's racial profiling, selective enforcement, and entrapment practices that already hurt the U.S. Muslim population.
Those laws which have been made, they have been selectively applied to the Muslim community, which has further fueled Islamophobia. It's the job of the government to guide the citizens to do and say the right thing. It's not the job of the government to trick the citizens to do and say the wrong thing, and then you nab them. We have been victim. This law will have a further negative impact and will be applied to the Muslim community.
In his signing statement, President Obama promised to treat as non-binding any provision of the bill that conflicts with his authority to uphold the Constitution or violates the separation of powers. But Shana Katadal from the Center for Constitutional Rights says the bill gives the executive branch unprecedented power, expanding on the Authorization for Use of Military Force Act signed by President Bush in 2001.
Now, you might wonder, with Osama bin Laden dead now and the war on terror, you know, potentially sort of reaching an end, why Congress would see fit to expand it.
The bill also extends indefinitely another emblem of the post-9/11 years, the U.S. detention camp at Guantanamo Bay. Though the president promised to work around any efforts to prevent the closure of the base, Katadal says Congress's transfer ban has so far been effective.
More than half the people at Gitmo are people that the president wants to let go, but can't because Congress has put this roadblock in his way. And actually, in the 11 months since this roadblock has been in place, there hasn't been a single person transferred out of Guantanamo. And that's actually the longest stretch of time in the nearly 10-year history of the prison without having anyone sent home.
Next week, activists from across the country will gather in Washington, D.C. to protest the continued detention of more than 170 men at the naval base at Guantanamo. And Akhtar says he and other civil rights activists plan to challenge the National Defense Authorization Act as unconstitutional in court. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In South Sudan, tens of thousands of people have been displaced by recent tribal fighting. The government and the UN has sent more forces to the region, and the UN has warned of a major tragedy unless the situation is resolved. Up to 50,000 are estimated to be without food, water, and shelter. Meanwhile, NGOs, many of whom provide the only services available to local residents, are struggling to maintain their work. For more, we're joined by William Logai Oncheng. He's executive director of Hope Orfiria, a non-governmental organization that works on development projects in South Sudan. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Your staff in South Sudan is located in Torit. That's also where you are from. How close is it to Jonglei, where much of the current conflict is taking place, and is your staff still able to operate there?
Torit is very far from Jonglei. We don't operate in Jonglei. Of course, even if we work in restricted in Magui County, we still coordinate with so many different non-governmental organizations, Sudanese local NGOs, international NGOs. With this current situation that is happening in Jonglei, we are all concerned and we follow it closely.
And with that situation, there are reports of people displaced by the current fighting. The UN says tens of thousands have fled the conflict. What kind of support is there for these displaced people?
And as far as I know, as somebody who has been working in the ground in southern Sudan during the conflict, I don't think there is any support that actually are being provided to these people. There are a lot of organizations that are trying to get in. I understand that San Francisco Medicine was actually, they were trying to get into the area, and their clinic were burned down, a lot of medicines were taken because of the fight that is taking place now. Of course, there are pockets of relief getting in there, but when you look at the number of people who are displaced, what they get simply is not enough to cover that big number of people who are displaced.
The fighting right now is between the Lo Niue people and the Morolai. What is the cause of the current conflict and why this is taking place now?
So the main cause of the fighting or the conflict is actually cattle raiding. If you get my word clearly, cattle raiding means a group of people come and steal cows from one group, and the same group will go back and steal the same cow from people who have stolen from the cow.
And the issue is really over that property, over cattle, and over who controls it?
Yeah, the issue is when they steal, and then it belongs to the tribal community, it belongs to that tribe as a group of people. Because in southern Sudan, as I say, people identify on a tribal line. Say, the Nuer, when they come to if the Murule comes down to Nuer and they raid cattle in big numbers. This is not about one or two or three. They take them in hundreds or in thousands. And then this cow belongs to the tribe. Now the Nuer would like to go back and bring their cow back. And this is where the conflict now will result. Because people who steal this cow from them, the Murule who steal the cow from Nuer, will defend those cows they have stolen. So what will happen as a result? Of course, here war will come in. People start shooting each other, either by gun, spears, or whatever. In the process, people die. And this is exactly what is happening now. It is not a political war. It is not political differences. It's complete cattle raiding.
Well, if you're describing a long-running conflict such as this, talk about the work that you do with your organization, Hope Orferia, there in South Sudan. How does that connect to these issues of conflict and this issue of which inevitably causes displacement of people? Talk about the work your organization does in reference to that.
Yeah, what we do, as I said before, because we know that It is not only Nuer and Murule that have this tribal hatred. Across Southern Sudan, we have a big problem with the tribal hatred, where one tribe believe that they are better than the other tribe, and it's the whole way from my region all the way to Jonglei, and then from Jonglei up to Wau. We have this problem. But what we do as an organization, we realize that if we don't believe in the diversity, we cannot go very far. So we also try to diffuse the attention by having workshop, you see. And tribal war, we also come in and mediate. We have done in the past, and we are still doing it even now. We mediated conflict. We have stopped actually fight, which would have occurred through our local educational workshop, what we call reconciliation at a community level.
And you believe the strategy of reconciliation, of talking, is possible as a solution for these kinds of conflicts?
Yes, I believe that is possible. It is possible on one condition, that the mediator look at both parties that they have a genuine interest in the war. Because nobody can go and die when they don't have genuine interest in that war. Genuine interest result into conflict. Look at the two sides. What is the problem of Murule and what is the problem of the Nuer, which I believe are cattle. So find out their problem and work best from what they want. Don't impose condition. Be neutral. And our approach, even as you see the women we work with, we don't give them what we think is good for them. They tell us what is good for them, and we work from what they think is good for them. And I think if they believe, that if we use the same approach, or the government in Southern Sudan, who are currently engaged in that problem, they look at the problem from the interest of the two parties. They will get a solution, rather than using force. Because force will make things worse.
William Logai Ocheng is the executive director with Hope Orferia, a non-governmental organization working in South Sudan. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, and I look forward to talk with you again in the future.
Those were some of your international headlines brought to you by Free Speech Radio News. Thanks to them for bringing us those international headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia.
Get your midweek Roots music fix every Wednesday evening with Folk Oasis, featuring the latest releases from Canadian and especially BC artists,
as well as phone interviews and live studio sets with local and touring artists. Folk Oasis, two eclectic hours of roots music, always a Kumbaya free zone. Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. on CITR-FM 101.9 and www.citr.ca.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. Now we have your weekly weather forecast brought to you by the Weather Office from Environment Canada.
Yep, and it's not looking very good, although Ontario is getting extreme weather warnings. We don't have that. We're not going to get any snow or anything, but it's not going to be nice. Not nice at all. And it's going to start right now, tonight. Showers. We're going to get wind east of 30 kilometers an hour, but coming southeast, 40 to 60 early this evening, but then it's going to hit really hard, gusting up to 50 and 80 kilometers an hour this evening. Temperature is pretty much going to be steady near 7 degrees. And the rest of the week, right through to Sunday, is pretty much almost the same thing. Not quite as much wind, but Tuesday it's going to be periods of rain, about 15 to 25 millimeters. Windy, temperature steady at about 8. Tuesday night, more of the same, another 20 millimeters. Windy, steady at 8. Wednesday, windy, high of 10. Rain. Thursday, showers, low of 6, high of 8. Friday, cloudy, 70% chance of showers. It's just going to rain pretty much for the rest of your life. So get some rain gear and try and enjoy it. And hopefully might get something better next week, but it really doesn't look like it.
Probably.
7 degrees and rain for the entire week.
Yeah.
That is your weekday weather forecast. Brought to you by Environment Canada. Thank you so much for that uplifting message.
If just get a hot chocolate and read a book inside.
Yeah.
Great. Now to continue our international segment, we go back to Free Speech Radio News.
The Occupy protesters in Iowa have seen their numbers dwindle and then explode this week ahead of tomorrow's Republican presidential caucus. FSRN's Matt Laszlo is in Des Moines with this report on the movement.
At a quiet and very cold park in Iowa City, about 20 tents are spread out. The police stop by the historic College Green Park every once in a while, sometimes demanding things of the protesters, such as putting every belonging inside their tents. But many people in this college town are behind the movement, even donating a portable toilet and a solar panel to keep the communal tent warm. Mike Tibbetts has been a part of the movement since the first day. He says the GOP contest has been good for them.
They're actually adding to the attention that the occupancy has, because not as a political movement. I think that given the fact that indeed Iowa is a real swing state or primary in the caucuses, I think that if, for example, the Occupy movement, whether it be 1.4 million, that's quite a swing vote when it comes down, boils down to it. Now, when it comes down to the GOP candidates, simply put, empirically, if you don't win Iowa, you don't get the Republican nod or the Democratic nod, depending on the situation. So I think that they're actually giving us more attention than we would have had otherwise.
While things were peaceful in Iowa City, they heated up at Michelle Bachmann's headquarters in Des Moines, where 18 protesters were arrested.
Corporate money out of our democracy now!
The whole world is watching!
It wasn't a planned arrest. The protesters were booted because it was private property, and they wanted to show their public opposition to Bachmann and many of these other candidates who they say are being hypocrites. Another candidate who has angered the protesters is Texas Governor Rick Perry. He calls himself a political outsider. Here's how he put it as he worked a crowd at a coffee shop in western Iowa.
And you can choose among these various insiders who have spent, I think I added it up, it's 63 years in Congress that have been driving up the debt, and they've been involved with earmarks. Or you can pick a governor who signed six balanced budgets, who understands the importance of living within your means.
Perry says he wants to make Congress part-time and shake up the establishment, yet he's raising millions of dollars from oil interests and other special interests. All of the GOP candidates are pushing policies that would drastically undercut social services and things that the protesters say help the 99%. Many want to eliminate government agencies that people depend on. Former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum says he's the candidate who will not just eliminate government departments, but actually eviscerate the laws that are the underpinnings of those agencies.
I don't like the word eliminate, because you can't eliminate unless you eviscerate. And let me explain why. I mean, I love these politicians who go out and say, I'm going to eliminate this department and that department and this department. Show me any history that you've ever eliminated anything like that in our country's history, number one. Number two, show us a record that you've been successful in doing that in your own political career.
But Occupy protester Tibbetts says the candidates are blind to what the people really need.
We won't put up with it anymore. When it comes down to, for example, the inherent contradictions of the existing forms of capitalism, democratic capitalism, where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, I believe when it comes down to 99 to 1%, we the people would probably settle for 60, 40, 70, 30 if you ask nice.
Over in western Iowa, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney is trying to gain support at a rally on a cool January night. Steve Smith of Council Bluffs came out to wave a sign and speak with people attending the event. He says he's fed up with politics as usual.
I think Romney would be more of the same. He'd be another Obama. Obama said he would give us change. He hasn't given us anything. And Bush just went ahead and screwed up the country. I mean, Bush was the first one to do the bailouts, and then Obama continued them. I think Romney would continue to bail out big business and support wars that support the military-industrial complex.
The Iowa Occupy movement shrunk during the holiday, but now it exploded because of the caucus, with visitors coming from across the U.S. Smith says until Wall Street and politicians get the message, he's not letting up.
But our movement is still alive and well. I mean, don't let the numbers fool you. Basically, Romney represents another Bush, and he stands up for Wall Street. He's Wall Street's candidate, and people need to know that. I mean, he's not their man.
With the caucus on Tuesday, the protesters say they're gaining new energy and more attention. And they say they're not ready to give up yet, especially as they watch this race unfold and tilt away from their needs. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Iowa.
Oil is now washing ashore in some coastal communities in Nigeria, a week after the country recorded its worst oil spill in more than a decade. Over 1 million gallons of oil were spilled into the ocean 75 miles off the coast from a deepwater oil field operated by the Anglo-Dutch company Shell. Satellite images showed the spill initially covered more than 350 square miles, an area the size of Dallas, Texas. Shell is the largest oil producer in the country and has been accused of arming militias to protect pipelines and contributing to massive environmental destruction. The company maintains that they have contained the latest spill, but environmental groups and local fishermen are pushing to hold the oil giant accountable. FSRN's Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
As waves from the Atlantic Ocean hit the Nigerian coastline, it brings with it spilled crude oil from the sea. Ibeno, a village whose coastal waters have suffered incessant oil spills in recent years, is one of the communities affected by the recent oil spill. Local resident John Etim says the situation makes it difficult for them to carry out fishing, which is their traditional occupation.
Oh, it affects every fisherman, because before now, we can just go to the beach and make a catch. But now, if you don't buy a 40 horsepower, you cannot go into the deep sea to fish. So it affects people who cannot afford 500,000 and above to buy 40 horsepower engine to go into the high sea. So we can no more do creek fishing or stream fishing, except in the high sea. So every fisherman is affected here.
Environmentalists say Shell's oil spill at its offshore platform is responsible for the pollution the coastal communities are experiencing. But the company says the pollution must have come from a different company. Many news agencies are reporting that the spill has been contained. This report on a Nigerian television station suggested that there is no link between the oil at the coastal communities and the spillage at the offshore platform, because Shell and its subsidiaries acted promptly after the spillage.
Just for a double check, we embarked also to see the site. So having some convincing pictures with a clean bill, we sought to know from SNEPCO's management how this didn't become a disaster.
But the Environmental Rights Action, a Nigerian group which has been monitoring oil spills in the region, disagrees with Shell. Bode Olufemi, an official of the group, says the oil appearing at the coastal communities could only have come from Shell's Bonga offshore platform where last week's spillage occurred.
What Shell again is now telling us, and we have no reason to believe, is that the oil that are now approaching the coastal lines in Bayelsa, in Delta States, are not, is from a third party. And of course, we all know that this is not true, because the only spill that is recorded now at this point is the one from Bonga. See, another evidence is the fact that satellite images that we have obtained have shown clearly that these spills are moving towards the coastline, and there is no other spill that is moving towards the coastline. And that is enough evidence for us to hold Shell responsible for what is happening at the coastline.
Environmental Rights Action urged the Nigerian government to independently verify the size of the oil spill rather than rely on company estimates. A Senate committee has directed government officials to collect samples of the oil washing ashore to determine its origin. This summer, the United Nations warned that undoing environmental damage from decades of oil spills in the region would already take nearly 30 years and could cost $1 billion. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
In Syria today, security forces continue to crack down on protesters, leaving some 40 dead, according to activists and the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The violence comes despite the presence of monitors from the Arab League, who are on a mission to report on human rights abuses in the country. Since their arrival, the regime of Bashar al-Assad has shown few signs of decreasing the violence that has killed more than 5,000 during the past 10 months. For more, we're joined by Dr. Khaldun al-Aswad. He's with the National Coordination Body, a Syrian opposition group, and a member of the Damascus Center for Theoretical and Civil Rights Studies. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Since the arrival of the Arab League monitors, there seems to be little change in the behavior of the Assad regime. Activists posted videos this week that showed monitors even having to take cover with shots ringing out, protesters fleeing in homes during their visit. Do you see this mission as having credibility or cause for hope in changing the situation?
I definitely see this mission has affected the behavior of the regime slightly. In fact, in Hama, the regime for the first time did not use live bullets the first day. They used water guns and tear gas canisters. But the problem with this mission that the monitors' numbers are limited. There are more than 350 hot points in the whole country of Syria for about 75 monitors. And cities are big, there are large population. The numbers of those monitors need to be increased significantly to be able to control the situation. In addition to that, the Syrian regime never shown regard to the citizens' lives. I think the Syrian regime also shows less regard to Arab monitors' lives sometimes. So the behavior of the Syrian regime is expected.
What about the monitors themselves? The Arab League monitors are supposed to be assessing the situation, the allegations of human rights violations. The man leading the mission, Lieutenant General Mohammed al-Dabi of Sudan, has been criticized. Earlier this week, he called the findings reassuring, even as protesters were being fired upon by security forces. How do you view his role?
Well, we hoped as a Syrian opposition that his role will be just a coordination between the monitors. I heard that he was given more say in directing the mission than it was supposed to be for a monitor's mission. So we actually voiced our concerns to the Arab League General Assembly and the Arab League Secretary, and we hope his role will be limited to administrative issues in the monitor's mission. So we agree with the criticism about his role and about his assignment. He has been criticized by some international human rights organization about his roles in Sudan, but we hope that by limiting his roles to administrative issues, that will overcome this hurdle.
And the role in Sudan you're referring to is his role as a former intelligence advisor to President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, who is wanted now by the International Criminal Court.
That's actually correct. He was asked to go testify in front of the International Criminal Court, and had he accepted the invitation, he would have a hard time going back to his country. So I heard he refused to go testify against Omar al-Bashir, the current president of Sudan.
You mentioned weighing in and giving your opinion to the Arab League monitors, some of your concerns. As a member of the Damascus Center for Theoretical and Civil Rights Studies, are you in any contact, or is your organization in contact with the Arab League?
As part of the Syrian opposition, we are actually in contact with the Arab League. Dr. Haitham Manna, who is the secretary of the National Coordination Body outside Syria, is actually in direct contact with the Arab Leagues on a daily basis. And Arab Leagues actually seeks and solicits our opinion in every step it takes in this crisis.
And what have you heard from people on the ground in Syria about developments this week as the monitors are visiting these towns?
Well, yesterday I got a phone call from one of the activists on the ground I can't identify for his safety, that the people of Daraa thought that the monitors are in the city, so they took to the streets in a peaceful demonstration, and at least two were killed by the security service and scores injured. He estimated the numbers at least 20 to 30 people were injured gravely.
Dr. Khaldun Al-Aswad is with the Damascus Center for Theoretical and Civil Rights Studies. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to speak to you.
Well, those were our international headlines brought to you by Free Speech Radio News. Thanks to them for bringing us that report. For more of their daily headlines and their full newscast, you can go to their website, fsrn.org.
And that's our program for today, January 2nd, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us through email at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to podcasts and listen to past shows at citr.ca. Or for more news, join us right here, Mondays and Fridays, at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lamlin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Martin. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening and have a happy new year. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.